All right. We're in 1 Kings, and from what I understand from Richard, that you kind of began to finish up the reign of Solomon. Again, this is what we call the United Kingdom period. The way God intended for his people to be as one nation, and yet it only lasted through what we know to be 3 kings. And I don't know if we're going to get to begin to talk about Solomon's son tonight or not. But nonetheless, there was only 3 kings, Saul, David, and Solomon. Saul being the king that God chose first. And I'd like to make the point that in terms of whether or not Saul, you can look the part or you can be the part. Saul, which one was Saul? He looked the part. He looked like a king, but he didn't have the heart of a king. Then God chose David as he chose Saul. But David didn't look the part, but he had the heart of a king. And again, he was the one that was man after God's own heart. And then we have the reign of Solomon, and that's who we've been talking about. And addressing the aspect that God granted to Saul one request. His request was what?
Well, he had long life in the end, but that he had everything that he needed because he asked for wisdom.
Wisdom and discernment to be able to lead the people. And God blessed him with riches and honor. Talk about the point, as I filled in for Richard, that he had wisdom, and God did indeed grant him wisdom. And when you read the book of Proverbs, when you read the book of Ecclesiastes that he wrote, is there any doubt that he had God's wisdom? Now, the problem with Solomon was he didn't live what he wrote down. He didn't practice what and put into practice in his life those things that God had revealed to him. For those who were here Sunday, talk about the Queen of Sheba, okay, and how, again, she had heard of the fame of Solomon, and Solomon showed all of his wealth to her. And it's interesting, what were some of the indications in chapter 10 of the degree of wealth that Israel and Solomon had at that time? Right, that's the one I always remember, was that to him, if there were silver coins, they were like pebbles on the street. They didn't mean anything. Today those are, high-priced, valuable coins. To Solomon in that day, it was just another thing. He was extremely blessed. And then you get to chapter 11, and the aspect that towards the end of his life, what turned his heart away?
His women and those are the things that they worship.
Right. His verse 3 specifically said, again, he has 700 wives, princesses, and 300 concubines. And the end of that verse says, and his wives turned his heart away. The question, we have to ask, does it take 700 wives and 300 concubines to turn a man's heart away? No, in fact, how many people can it take to turn one heart away?
Actually, just yourself.
That's bottom line. You can, just through the things of this life, you could turn your heart away. But if you have, as your closest circle of people, and you have those who you're trying to please and make happy, those who have different spiritual values, have a different standard of authority, have different values and practices in their life, and you're trying to make them happy and please them, you can see how they would turn your heart away, David.
Yeah, just as proof of what you're saying, in 1 Kings 11 and verse 7, then Solomon built a high place for Chemosh, the abomination of Moab, in the hill that is before Jerusalem, and for Moab, the abomination of the children of Ammon. And likewise did he for all his strange wives, which from incense and sacrifice them to their gods.
He was trying to accommodate those whom he had married, wasn't he?
We were studying about water, but some people say it wasn't really a false god. It was actually demon worship. And God made a special point in Leviticus to say to anybody, in fact, if you came into, a foreigner came in to Israel or Judah and brought in the worship of Moloch, they were supposed to stone him, whoever brought it in. They didn't have to be a Jew. And then it said to anybody that worshiped, they're supposed to stone. So under the law, Solomon should have stoned.
Well, and again, if you go back to the very beginning of their inhabitant of the Promised Land, who was to remain in the Promised Land after they conquered it? Right. And again, the lesson for us is, in terms of those elements of the world, those elements of sin, those elements in our lives that perhaps have been the thorns in our side, what are we to do? You know, you talk about it in Ephesians, Colossians, it talks about those things we're to put away, we're to get rid of. And to me, that's like those, you know, the nations that inhabited the land, they were to completely get rid of them and not leave little remnants. The temptation for us is those things that have plagued us. It's to leave a little bit in our life, not to completely rid our life of those things that have caused us to go astray, that have been sources of temptation. We tend to want to leave a little bit. You know, it's kind of like we're going to go on that diet, but we're still going to leave that box of cookies up there in the pantry. You know, we don't want to throw those out. We don't want to get rid of them. We leave that source of temptation there. And that's what they did from the very beginning. So God was not pleased. In fact, verse 9 of 1 Kings chapter 11, the Lord was angry with Solomon. After all that God had done for David his father, that God had done for him, blessed him so richly, and yet his heart now had been turned away. And again, God was angry. Verse 11, so the Lord said to Solomon, because you have done this, you have not kept my commandment and my statutes I have commanded you, I will surely tear the kingdom from you and give it to your servant. Nevertheless, I will not do it in your days for the sake of your father David, but I will tear it out of the hand of your son. However, I will not tear away all the kingdom, but I will give one tribe to your son for the sake of my servant David, for the sake of Jerusalem, which I have chosen. Now, it goes back to the very point in terms of the promises. He talked about the promises made to his father David. And again, where do we read of those promises and what are they? The promise to David?
Kingdom won't depart from your house.
I'm sorry?
Kingdom won't depart from your house.
Yeah, that one of his descendants would be on the throne forever. Right? That's anybody remember where that's at?
2 Samuel 7.
Very good. 2 Samuel 7. And verse, I believe, 13-14, somewhere in there. 13, he shall build a house for my name. I'll establish the throne of his kingdom forever. I'll be a father to him, and he'll be a son to me. When he commits iniquity, I'll correct him with the rod of men, the strokes of sons of men. But my loving kindness shall not depart from him, as I took it away from Saul, whom I removed from before you. And your house and your kingdom shall endure before me forever, and your throne shall be established forever. So that's the promise that he is talking about here in terms of why the whole kingdom would not be taken away from his son, from Solomon's son. And we'll talk about how it's communicated to the prophet in terms of how it would be taken away. But again, he talks about, for the sake of my servant David, for which I have chosen. Again, that's why the whole kingdom's not taken away. Beginning in verse 14, the Lord raised up an adversary to Solomon.
God will raise adversaries when we, you know,
when we leave his paths, when we no longer are following him, will God provide those situations in life to help turn us back, to remind us of our sin? Here we see God again raising adversaries against Solomon. We see his departure from Solomon. It begins with Hadad the Edomite and goes on from there. Verse 23, God also raised up another adversary to him, Rezon the son of Eliada, who had fled from Hadadezer. In verse 25, so he was an adversary to Israel all the days of Solomon, along with the evil that Hadad did, and he abhorred Israel and reigned over Aram. We then see again the first reference beginning in verse 26 to Jeroboam, the son of Nebat. And again, we understand that Jeroboam was an Israelite. See, he was Solomon's servant. Verse 27, now this was the reason why he rebelled against the king. Solomon built the Milo and closed up the breach of the city of his father David. Now the man Jeroboam was a valiant warrior. When Solomon saw that the younger man was industrious, he appointed him over all the forced labor of the house of Joseph. And it came about at that time when Jeroboam went out of Jerusalem that the prophet Ahijah the Shilonite found him on the road. Now Ahijah had clothed himself with a new cloak, and both of them were alone in the field. Then Ahijah took hold of the new cloak which was on him and tore it into 12 pieces. And he said to Jeroboam, take for yourself 10 pieces. Thus says the Lord, the God of Israel, behold, I will tear the kingdom out of the hand of Solomon and give you 10 tribes. Verse 32, but he will have one tribe for the sake of my servant David and for the sake of Jerusalem, the city which I have chosen from all the tribes of Israel, because they have forsaken me and have worshipped Ashtoreth, the goddess of the Sidonians, Chemosh, the god of Moab, and Milcom, the god of the sons of Ammon. They have not walked in my ways, doing what is right in my sight and observing my statutes, my ordinances, as his father David did. Nevertheless, I will not take the whole kingdom out of his hand, but I will make him ruler all the days of his life for the sake of my servant David, whom I chose, who observed my commandments and my statutes. So the way in which he talks reveals to Jeroboam is he takes the cloak and he cuts it into 12 pieces. Says, 10 of these are yours. God has given it into your hand. Now, what's the problem with the math of what I just read?
Now it's 10 pieces instead of 12.
Now he talks about there's 10 pieces. And yeah, he only said that Rehoboam was going to have one. 10 plus one is. It's not 12. So how do we reconcile that? Because of Benjamin, which
didn't really exist except the
kind of within the tribe of Judah. So yeah, Judah included Benjamin, right? So it was kind of refers to Judah, but that included the tribe of Benjamin. So God has spoken. Now, any comments or thoughts in terms of the end of Solomon's life, how he finished?
Dr. Johnson, kind of just comparative smaller of what I think the Lord had promised him a long life to have if he kept his commandments.
Right.
But he did that, which is. But probably in his 60s.
At what point do we stop concerning ourselves about our heart being turned away from God? Is there an age you can get to when you can say, I'm safe? No. Unfortunately, there's not. And I've known throughout my life too many examples of those who I was shocked at later years of life, whether through spouses or through other factors, had their hearts turned away from God. And that's disappointing, because I always, I guess, naively thought when I was younger as a Christian that at a certain point in time I'd get to that point where I was so grounded, I was so firm, so convinced, so sure of truth that that danger would go away.
Thank you.
Well, not so much... That I wouldn't be swayed so much by the things of this life.
congregation or worship before, you want a woman who now was old enough to retire, and she made a comment during a ladies' class one time about, she didn't retire from that, she didn't say she retired from the Lord exactly, but now she was retired, so she didn't have to teach, she didn't have to do any of the stuff. And if you have that mindset, now you're not going to be active working for the Lord, then where else can you go? Everything else is going to become more important. And that was, she retired. And when she retired, it was like she stopped working for the Lord. And as far as I was concerned, that was the downhill slide.
And then what happened to the other women teaching the younger? And if someone retires, you would think they would have more time rather than less than the younger women who were.
Well, that's exactly the point. I mean, is there work for older Christians to do? Again, Titus chapter 2 talks about that. You know, is there work for younger Christians to do? Absolutely. You know, again, we're all parts of the body, but, you know, what you talk about is the fact that we use a term at work about, we talk about employee engagement. We've talked about employees being engaged in their jobs, and when I use that word, what do you think I'm referring to? I'm talking about employees who are not just devoted to their jobs, but to one of the terms I've heard is they use their discretionary efforts, you know, on the job. They're looking for ways to contribute. I mean, they're concerned about, you know, the company they work for and the outcome, and they're invested in it, and they're giving it their all, and they're busy with the work to do, and they're looking to contribute. And when we talk a lot about that at work, you know, how engaged our employees, how, you know, but then I think in terms of being a child of God, how engaged are we in the work of the church? And at some point in our lives, does our engagement level drop? Are we less concerned about the work of the church, less concerned about how we can contribute, how we can add something to the body of Christ? Bruce?
You know, in the real world, when you speak of employee engagement, it doesn't seem like it's a people-oriented type of, you know, type of model. You know, it seems like, you know, that we want to keep everybody, you know, in the company that we're able to keep in the company, you know, and find those people who want to engage in doing that. But as far as the Lord's church, it's more than that. It's in engaging with one another. But first of all, engaging in Christ, and then engaging with one another to build one another up. Just like Titus says, you know, older men and older women need to teach the younger men and the younger women. And then not only that, but to be sound and doctrine. So it's a
right.
And teach them to love their husbands and their wives and their children too. So it goes, you know, even beyond that.
Right. So
I heard something.
No, but that's absolutely true. And again, absolutely, you know, whether we're young or old, our role within the church, the church needs all of us to contribute something to again be engaged in the work that we do together, as opposed to again is being engaged in the work we do here in this congregation. Am I engaged if I'm here intermittently and I'm simply I come, I sit, I listen, and I leave? Is that engaged in the work of the church and in those things that the Lord would have for me to do? So, you know, God needs our commitment, but again, the point is He needs it at every age of our life. We need the young people engaged in the work of the church. We need those who are parents and, you know, raising children. We need those who are older. We need those who have experience to impart their wisdom. And it's funny when we talk about imparting the wisdom that the older generation has learned. And the irony of Solomon's son and the fact that he didn't see the value of the wisdom of those who had gone before him. But we won't get to that yet. But Solomon, again, a fascinating example, like so many others. And when we get into the divided kingdom, how many other kings were committed to God early? We'll get to King Asa, who gave his heart to God and went to God for his source of help until the later years of his life, and then he turned to human sources for his strength. And again, there's so many examples of those who start out strong, but again, as life goes on, they lose their focus, they lose their commitment.
Is that the same Asa who became king as a young man, and they found the scriptures, he read the scriptures, daily, to the congregation?
I think you're thinking of Josiah, who became king at like 6 or 7 years old, and who found the book of the law and had it read. But Asa was I don't remember the age at which he became king, but he reigned for like nearly 40 years. But again, later on in life, he turned his heart away from depending upon God to depending on human kings.
Quite a few of the kings did, if we get to that. Some of them didn't turn completely wicked, but one of them, extended his life and stuff, and then his son was one of the most wicked kings.
It's Hezekiah.
And he was Hezekiah, Manasseh.
Yeah.
Was very wicked. That was his son, and he was born after him those last 15 years that God had it. So somehow he didn't teach his son after he got it.
All right, that's another curiosity as we will proceed into the divided kingdom. Of how many of the good kings were not able to raise good sons, and for whatever reason, then that it is an interesting fact. But again, just the point of time and again, those who start out and get so committed to God and loving truth and wanting to do what's right and taking the right actions. And then as time goes on, again, they lose their commitment, they lose their focus. They begin to, like David said, not necessarily just completely turn their back on God, but they begin to be compromised. Again, it's not only just worshiping God, but they allow some idolatry. And again, that's, the Hebrew writer talks about the fact that in chapter 2 and verse 1, do people normally, quote, sprint away from the Lord? What is the word in Hebrews 2 and 1? They drift. And again, solely over compromise, changes, lack of commitment, lack of focus in our lives to God's word, we begin to drift. Judah's and Israel's kings drifted. And we see again here over time, would you say what happened to Solomon as something that a light switch just, turned off in his life? No, again, his wives helped turn his heart. And again, it said there in chapter 11 that, his wife turned his heart away. I'd like to suggest that wasn't on Tuesday, his heart was on fire for God, and on Wednesday, his heart, had flipped a switch. I'm excited about the things that gradually happened in our lives. And Solomon's heart turning was a gradual process. But his wives obviously were instrumental in that.
Quite often say that God answers prayer and say thank you for answering our prayer, but I think what people mean is thank you for saying yes, when in actuality God answers every prayer. Sometimes it's yes, sometimes it's no, and sometimes it's when it's his time, not our time. But we don't seem to acknowledge anything except a yes answer. And I think as when you say drifting away, from personal experience, I can tell you that I wanted God to fix my life. And I wanted it this way, and I wanted it now, and exactly, and I had a step laid out. I had an outline. Well, he answered my prayer, but it wasn't in my outline. And that's when I said, well, okay, if you're not going to answer my prayer the way I want it, I don't have time to do either. And and I think that's a lot of the scripting away thing is that, God didn't answer my prayer, God didn't do what I wanted, if we would take the time to stop and think. Because most of the time, probably all the time, when he answers the prayer, it's to our advantage. see that, but it's to our advantage. That if we would just bring our life into that, you know, parallel with his, we'd be okay.
Well, it comes down to the fact that do we really believe that God knows what's best for our lives?
Exactly.
And do we have the humility to submit to that?
Yeah.
That's a hard
thing. That's submission.
That's a hard thing.
It's submission.
Yeah. Of taking our will. Again, that's the key to us being pleased with God. We all have wills. We all have want-tos. The things we want to do, the things we will to do, and how to take that will. And say, I know what I want in my relationships, I know what I want in my life, and I know the things I want to have, but it's what God wants.
And you know, maybe this is just from my particular point of view, but being a woman in America, that's one of the things that seems like we are trained from childhood to do is be strong, independent people. And a strong, independent person finds it very difficult sometimes to submit their will to anybody, especially God, because it's not always what we want.
Well, it's not just women, but in our society, men in our society, are we to be dependent upon somebody else, someone else? No. But again, in Proverbs, Solomon, it was said, don't lean on your own understanding, right? Learn to depend on him, and what?
One of the things that hits really a key point in my thinking is that a lot of these guys had direct lines to God. Like, they got, if they didn't talk to God directly, they had somebody telling them exactly what to do, how to do it, how many measurements, what to use. So they had this very, very close connection with them, and they still went away. And so us today who do not have that exact connection, I mean, I know there's the Bible and praying, but we don't have that kind of connection. It's almost like you can sit there and see that it's way harder now than it would be for Solomon. You would sit there and say, Solomon could talk to God. He could sit there and ask a question and get it answered and say, is this the correct measurement or whatnot? Almost to that effect. And they still turned away. That's kind of crazy to me. I'm just like, that. How much does that say about us now? How strong do you have to be to get through that when you have people that were turned away from God that had a connection with God?
And then the point is that you're right, he did. And it still wasn't enough for Solomon, right? And how, oftentimes when I think, well, yeah, if I had that one-on-one conversation with God, I would never.
Rich man and Lazarus.
I was going to say the rich man and Lazarus, exactly. You know, the rich man wanted to send Abraham back, or Lazarus back, to warn his family because surely they believed him. David,
I was thinking the rich man and Lazarus, that same quote, because it's kind of, I don't want to say coincidence, because God probably had a plan that way, but when Jesus raised Lazarus from the grave, the Jewish leaders did not believe then, and they tried to kill Lazarus, and sometimes he would have died twice. Yeah, so, even one comes from the grave, they're not going to believe in that.
Yeah. You know, it reminds me, there's a song, and I don't know what number it is, but we haven't sung it for a long time, but it's entitled We Saw Thee Not. And it talks about, we didn't see all these things happen, but we believe. And it's not so much whether you're an eyewitness or a direct hearer of the things, but what you do with it. But I'm like you. I mean, it just astounds me that Solomon, again, who, like I said, had those, he had conversations with God. And God rewarded him, and God blessed him. And God gave him the wisdom that he wrote down for us, and yet he couldn't follow it.
Jesus said it was how much better it is for us today that we believe than Thomas said
right.
Like that. And he said, blessed are those that believe without having touched.
Yeah. But it is impressive and kind of scary, though, too. John?
I think it's a lot of the reason that it seems so weird to us that they wouldn't take that is because we don't have it. We haven't had it for years and years. But now they kind of had it. It's like, first time you use that power tool, you know, you use a table saw, you've got all the protective gear on there, you've got everything set up right, you're being real careful. Like, after a couple of years, you just kind of take that off and push through the deal, right? So, after a while, you kind of, you know, things kind of lose their, you lose respect for it.
Okay.
You become complacent.
Yeah. When you talk about that, it makes me think real quick. Do you remember how carefully you drove the day after you got your license? I mean, it was I've been driving, and I need to be just as careful as I was the first day. Do I let my attention drift, or I let my focus wane a little bit sometimes as it should?
You know, it kind of makes me think, you know, that here King Solomon is. And you see that Sheba comes down, and he answers hard questions for her. And it kind of makes you wonder, well, what are some of those hard questions that he answered? But if he answered, you know, all the hard questions, then why not to some of the questions, you know, that she asked, turn her to God instead of him, you know, turning and getting everything that she has, you know? What are the hard questions?
Yeah.
Again,
knowing is one thing.
Yeah.
Doing something with is another. Again, one of my favorite verses. And for all my passwords at work, I use scriptures. One of my favorites is Ezra 7:10. Anybody know what that says? It's a pattern for life. Ezra set his heart to study the law of the Lord, to practice it, and to teach it in all Israel. To give the three things of life. Study, you got to have knowledge. Number two, you got to do it. And then God wants more people than simply know and do it. He wants people then who turn to get back to others and teaching it. Right? That's a foundation to life. But again, it's not enough to know. And that's why when we stop talking about Solomon, it's really easy to get academic when we study about Solomon ourselves and say, well, you know, there's where he went wrong and da-da-da-da. It's about, again, knowing that, and then what do we do about it?
Talking about Solomon, a different people there, and what it really does for me is show me how vulnerable I am, or how vulnerable we all are.
And I think that's kind of what you're talking about, too, is that vulnerability in terms of, yeah, if it can happen to Solomon. But, you know, 1 Corinthians 10, 12, 15, you know, David and Grant.
We see Solomon did the same thing in that he started off very humble and he started off doing it the way God wanted. But then somewhere along the line he got to depending on himself. He's king, he got to depend on himself. Solomon the same thing. And once you get dependent on yourself, then you're enticed by, you know, the world, and it's never enough. And then Proverbs, which is funny, but I guess Proverbs pretty well when you take the Solomon. Well, that says in Proverbs 27:20, it says, Sheol and Abaddon are never satisfied, and their eyes of men are never satisfied. So, I always want to know more.
Well, and we prosperity has a funny effect on people, doesn't it? A good effect? No, but not. David, could you read for us Deuteronomy 8:11-14?
Deuteronomy 8:11-14.
Actually, go all the way 11-18.
Beware lest thou forget Jehovah thy God in not keeping his commandments and his ordinances and his statutes, which I command thee this day, lest when thou eat and are full, and hast built godly houses and dwelt therein, and when thy herds and thy flocks multiply, and thy silver and thy gold multiply, and all that thou hast is multiplied, then thy heart be lifted up, and thou forget Jehovah thy God, who brought thee forth out of the land of Egypt, out of the house of bondage, who led thee through the great and terrible wilderness, within fire serpents, scorpions, thirsty ground, where there was no water. He brought thee forth water out of a rock, a cliff. He fed thee the wilderness with manna, which thy fathers knew not, that he might humble thee, and that he might prove thee to do thee good at the latter end. Lest thou say in your heart, my power, my might, and my hand have gotten me this well. But thou shalt remember Jehovah God, for it is he that giveth thee power to get well, that he may establish his covenant, which he sware unto thy father as at this day, and it shall be thee if thou shalt forget Jehovah thy God, and walk after other gods, and serve them, and worship them. I testify against thee in the day that ye shall surely perish.
Is this having a weak village to Solomon?
Oh, it was a prediction of all of them.
Right.
Well, actually, it kind of started back in the Judges. You saw, and when we studied that, you saw he did good, and things were good, and they got away from God. He sent punishment, and then they were humble, and then they went back to God.
Yeah. How well does man deal with prosperity?
Usually not very good.
From God's perspective, not very well. How well is our country doing with prosperity? Have we forgotten God who's blessed us with all this? So again, nobody was blessed to the degree that Solomon was. And yet, despite everything that God had done, we see Solomon's heart turning from him, forgetting God.
You were talking about the battle of yielding our will to his. And that was the yielding our will to his. Jesus said, Matthew 16, verse 24, Jesus said to his disciples, if anyone wishes to come after me, he must deny himself, take up his cross, and follow me. Whoever wishes to save his life will lose it, and whoever loses his life for my sake will find it. And what will it profit a man if he gains the whole world and forfeits his soul? Or what will a man give in exchange for his soul? The Son of Man is going to come in the glory of his Father with the angels, and will then repay every man according to his deeds. But it's just a simple. It's not so simple to obey, but it's a simple precept that Jesus is laying down.
Right.
You want to follow me.
You can't do what you want.
You can't do what you want.
You can't, yeah. Galatians 3, you cannot do the things that you please. You know, maybe that's Galatians 5, talking about the works of the flesh. Again, a lot of lessons from Solomon. Again, is prosperity the answer? You know, is another pay raise the answer for us in our lives? Is it you know, more possessions? Is that gonna, and again, who wrote the book of Ecclesiastes? Solomon again. What's the whole point of chapter 2? Solomon looked for the meaning of life and everything from possessions, and he found ultimately it wasn't there. It wasn't there. It was vanity and striving after wind. There was a lot of striving after wind in Solomon's life. Ironically, and I was reading something that kind of an ironic link. Turn to Ecclesiastes chapter 2. Again, the link in terms of, again, Solomon's son that was going to reign after him was named Rehoboam. We talked about how that sons don't always follow their fathers. Sometimes they do. Randy, could you read for us verse, chapter Ecclesiastes 2, verse 18 and 19?
Thus I hated all the fruit of my labor for which I had labored under the sun, for I must leave to the man who will come after me. And who knows whether he will be a wise man or a fool, yet he will have control over all the fruit of my labor for which I have labored by acting wisely under the sun. This too is vanity.
Think Rehoboam when you read those verses.
Yeah, he knew.
I never really made that link with reading those verses, but again, for all that Solomon had done, everything was left to his son, Rehoboam. And did he act wisely with the things that his father had left to him, that God had left him? I just thought I'd never really made that link of those verses to Rehoboam. But Solomon looked at life and said, you know, what's the point of working to accumulate so much and then you die and you leave it to somebody? And ultimately, he left it to someone who blew it.
So it's really interesting. Yeah, he lost it because he acted unwisely, but he acted unwisely because God took the kingdom away from him because Solomon acted unwisely. So it really was his.
Well, and again, we'll get to that. You know, did God change the character of Rehoboam to make him choose and make the decisions that he did?
No. One way or another, when Rehoboam was going to go take up his troops and go try to get it back, God said, no, no, go, this is from me. So it was from him. Whether he did it back, Rehoboam had composure, which he did or not.
Yeah.
But I think right after he did that, right after he asked the wise men, when he asked them, the guys that worked for him,
well, it was right. I mean, this was of God that
God ordained the division.
Right.
God ordained Jeroboam messed up because God had promised Jeroboam a kingdom that would last like David.
Right.
If he obeyed him, he didn't do it either.
Yeah.
But God ordained that division.
Yeah. But Rehoboam's choices were his own.
Oh yeah.
In terms of to act foolishly about, you know, the request that was made of him to begin to, you know, the idolatry that he continued.
It could have been down the road, because we see sometimes God postponed, like the postponement of the destruction of Jerusalem, because Joab decided so that he postponed. So it could have been postponed, but, you know, depending on what kind of king came in there.
Right. So, you know, again, that is interesting, John, in terms of the fact that, again, God was going to ensure. I mean, it's kind of the justice of God and the plan of God. God couldn't allow the wickedness of Solomon and the wickedness of Rehoboam to go unpunished. Yet he had the promises that he had made to David, again, and going back to Abraham, the promises to him that God was going to make sure those promises came true.
And then 1 Kings 12, verse 15, there's no doubt that they alone made a choice. God did not influence his will. But 15 says, so the king did not listen to the people, but the turn of events with the Lord, that he might establish his word, which the Lord spoke through Ahijah, the son of Jeroboam, the son of Joab. So it was a turn of events from the Lord. It just talks about how he listened to the young men instead of the old men.
It's kind of like God hardened Pharaoh's heart.
Right.
It's kind of that same principle. The circumstances that brought out made Jeroboam make those choices because he had that kind of heart.
Yeah, there you go.
But so I guess the point I'm trying to get across is, yes, there's wisdom in, you know, all of this is trying to have time because I don't know if the person I'm going to lead this to is going to be worthwhile. But the funny thing is, if Solomon had made all the right choices and followed that,
well, if Solomon hadn't multiplied wives and hadn't brought in idolatry, that right, just this whole, it's a moot point, then, right? The king, the United Kingdom continues on, and
first kingdom messes up.
I guess ultimately what I'm saying is this is squarely on Solomon. Not squarely, but this is a larger way as a result of his
action. Yeah, God said he was taking kingdom away from Solomon.
Right.
It was because of Solomon's action.
No, absolutely.
And, it's just like about the word idolatry, but Solomon turned to not only felt that one of the righteous places and set them up, but actually engaged in some worship. But idolatry in itself is worship. Whatever form of idolatry one does. That's why God abhors idolatry.
Right. Because it's portion of somebody other than the true creator.
You know, it seemed like David had set everything up, you know, for Solomon. So he had a problem. But again, Solomon, you know, at the end, it just seemed like if he lived longer, would he have done that? But, you know, you see him just turning and turning and turning. Why would we be loyal to listen to the younger when everything, when he could look back even in past history and pick up where David
is? Well, the bottom line is, I'm talking about Solomon, talking about Rehoboam, talking about my dad, talking about me, talking about Bruce, talking about his dad. We're all accountable for the choices we make and what we do with it. If you have a great father, it's still up to you to make the wise choices. If you have parents that make foolish choices and brought about consequences in your life and yourself to deal with, you've got to make the right choices. You know, it's that aspect of personal accountability.
Yeah, because we mentioned a while ago, we have good kings and have terrible. We had some terrible kings, and then their sons ended up being good kings. So, yeah, you have both ways.
Can children of God today come from broken homes and messy situations?
I was just going to say, you know, Paul warns us to, you know, do not be deceived, bad company corrupts good.